Hello, this is Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the weekly programme that brings you insights into the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can interact with the programme through Twitter at InsideEd or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you have feedback on a previous programme or an idea for a future programme, please get in touch. Never before in history has university education been available to so many people. One reason for this is the way in which universities can share resources using technology. One way that this has been done in the last number of years is through MOOCs, or Massive Open Online Courses. Since 2012, some of the top US universities, such as MIT, Harvard, and the University of California, Berkeley, have been offering MOOCs. In autumn 2014, Trinity College Dublin, TCD, became the first Irish university to offer a MOOC, and it is due to be offered again in March 2015. Tim Savage is the Associate Dean for Online Education in Trinity College Dublin. His research interests are the role of technology in enhancing higher education and the exploration of virtual worlds for learning. I met up with Tim Savage to find out more about the TCD MOOC offering and about his views of MOOCs in general. I first asked Tim to tell me what a MOOC is.
I suppose, Sean, the simplest definition is just the acronym, a massive open online course, which isn't very exciting in itself. But if you unpack that a little bit, it's a free online course, so there's no attendance needed at a physical campus. It's open, which means that there's absolutely no pre-qualifications needed. Anyone with an internet connection and a browser can sign up and take the course. And I suppose the massive part of it is really why it's generated so much interest recently. Courses can have up to 100,000 participants globally, or they can be as little as a couple of thousand.
So is it a little bit like distance learning in the computer age?
It's a little bit like the old model of distance learning. If we can remember, certainly for myself, on Saturday morning on BBC Two, there'd be a lady or a gentleman in black and white on a blackboard demonstrating sine waves. It's sort of got that model, but expanded with using all the modern communications technologies and our understanding of instructional design and teaching and learning. So it comes from that kind of distance field, but it's so much more than it used to be. I mean, the old correspondence course, if you remember, used to be printed materials or DVDs you would watch, but there'd be no interaction with your peers. Well, with a massive open online course, one of the big things, and it's one of my research areas, is about developing the community of learners, getting these thousands and thousands of people to engage with the content and then to engage with each other as well.
And can that not be overwhelming for the students involved because there's so many of them?
It can be, and in fact some of the latest research is looking at how do you break up these massive communities of thousands of learners into smaller groups. But certainly from our experience with our first MOOC that I know you want to talk about in a while, what we found was that you'd have a multimedia presentation on motivation of Irish people to fight in the First World War, for example, and that would generate a conversation with 600 comments from the 15, 12,000 or so people that were taking it. So we didn't find that to be too much of a barrier. Obviously, you get what people used to call lurkers, and now we call them read-only participants. It's much more politically correct. People who might not necessarily discuss things online, but they're still getting the benefit of reading all these other comments from their peers. So, in effect, they're listening in class to what their peers are saying. So, while it can be overwhelming, I think these days, especially with Facebook, everyone's much more used to communicating online. So it's probably more dynamic than most people would realise.
You offered your first MOOC in the autumn of 2014, and I think that's going to be offered again in March this year, is that right?
It is. The first run, it was Trinity's first MOOC, and depends how you define it, potentially Ireland's first massive-scale MOOC, started in August last year on Irish Lives in War and Revolution, 1910-1922. And we had 20,000 people sign up, of which 3,000 finished. Now, I know that sounds like, well, what happened to the other 17,000? But that's actually remarkably good figures for a MOOC. And it was very successful. And the next rollout of that is, I believe it's third week of March this year, and that's on the futurelearn.com platform.
And what have you learned from doing that?
We had a really interesting experience, because obviously when people think about online courses, they think, oh, well, it's very good just for kind of basic information or basic how-tos. We're all used to going onto YouTube to work out how to change a washer in a dripping tap. But I worked with three exceptional historians from the Department of History in Trinity, Anne Dolan, Kieran Brady and Kieran Wallace, professors and doctors and postgrads there. And what they said is, we want to do this period of history, but we don't want to do it in a factual way, Tim. We don't want to say, here's the main characters and here's the main dates. We want to somehow do a course where you're looking at authentic Irish lives. So how did a bookkeeper in Dublin experience it? How did somebody who worked in domestic service down the country experience these tumultuous events? So what we found interesting was being able to take this medium of an online course that's normally very factual based, but actually do much about creating these personalities and voices and characters. And that really struck a chord. So the short answer is, we learned that there's huge potentials in really interesting ways of teaching and learning using these massive online courses, if you just look beyond the standard, I'm going to tell somebody something and then they learn it, model of education.
And apart from what they learned on doing the MOOC, what did the 3,000 participants get at the end of it?
Apart from the learning, well, obviously the learning was the main thing we were going for. I suppose what they got was, certainly from some of the feedback and some of the analysis of we've been doing it, on the simplest level, they got a deep appreciation for the subject. They got a great sense of exploration. What we did a lot of in this MOOC as well was, we were getting people to share their individual stories from their family histories about that time, because obviously it's 100 years ago, so it's still part of the family memories. So people were getting their own stories and own families heard and discussed. On top of that, we had some very interesting things happen. So, for example, in Wexford Libraries, they were holding set evenings for people that were doing the MOOC to come along to the local library and physically meet
study groups
organised by the libraries. And these were spontaneous, and our historians went down, our provost went down to one of them. So there was interesting things coming out of it. I suppose on the simplest level, if you completed 50% of the course, you were eligible for a statement of participation from Future Learn at the payment of a small fee. I think it was about £20-24. You'd have a statement, they'd check your record to make sure that you'd contributed a certain amount. And then they gave you a statement, which, of course, you can then show to employers or to other interests, or just have it as a statement of accomplishment.
And why did Trinity College Dublin decide to get involved in offering MOOCs?
Short question, incredibly long answer. I suppose at the simplest level, Trinity is Ireland's leading university. We aspire to be a university of global consequence. But we're operating now very much in a globalised and digital higher education space. A MOOC is a very good way of raising the profile of an institution on that global scale. It's also quite scary, to be honest, because you are putting up your quality of teaching and learning online for everyone to see. And if you don't have a great course with great academics and correct content, you can damage your own reputation. So it's not a risk-free enterprise. But we put ourselves out there, and I think if you do want to be an institution on the global stage at the minute, you really have to be engaging in those activities, or else in terms of global recognition, you'll be falling behind purely by the dint of not engaging. So that's one reason. A second reason is that obviously it's very good for recognition of our expertise in a certain area. Students might be thinking about coming to Trinity, certainly on international students, but even domestic. And they say, oh, well, I can go and I can experience something of either this subject, how is history taught, or the actual quality of teaching and learning in the institution. So it allows them to kind of like try before you buy, to get a taste of it. But certainly for me, with my background in educational technology, what was really important for us was to give a real example to the faculty and the staff in Trinity of how we can envisage alternative ways of teaching and learning. It allows us to understand how you can engage students online, how to engage them between the weekly lectures and the seminars, for example, where we can use these techniques. We can put some content online, we can put resources online, get them to discuss with their peers online. So it's a very good way of demonstrating the power of technology-enhanced learning within college as well. So it's multiple aims and goals in there.
I suppose the big question is, you didn't charge students for it unless they wanted to get a certificate of participation. So how do you fund MOOCs, and how do you think they're going to be funded into the future? Or do you think there is a viable funding model for them?
There's two questions in there. I think I'll deal with the funding model in a while. Basically, we funded it internally ourselves. I mean, internationally, they'll say the cost of putting on a MOOC varies tremendously. For us, it was the cost of my instructional design team that created the videos, the multimedia content, the buying of the images and the copyright, and actually the cost of putting it together. The historians did this, in effect, they gave their services for free, and we're extremely grateful for them. They were extremely enthusiastic and engaging with it, and they saw it as part of their mission to actually share their knowledge outside of the walls of Trinity College. So they were very kind in that regards. But it is a substantial investment that we covered. I mean, we get a percentage of the fee for the statement of participation. In no way is that going to come even close to covering the costs. But to us, it had so many other benefits that it was worth investing in that. In terms of a revenue model going forward, well, if I answered that, I think I'd be a very rich man myself, because we have the large-scale platforms, Coursera and edX in the States, and FutureLearn itself, which is an offshoot of the Open University, the platform we're on. They're all struggling with this. Some people are saying, well, perhaps we can combine three or four MOOCs into a small suite and offer it to an industry sector for those that might be interested in doing it. Some consortiums are talking about the possibility of creating what's called SPOCs and actually charging a fee for those.
SPOCs is an acronym for Small Private Online Courses.
But at the moment, there's a lot of people trying to find a viable business model. In effect, there's a solution that's sort of looking for its problem in that regard, and that isn't resolved yet. My own feeling is that I don't think they're ever going to be revenue generating. However, they have so many less tangible benefits that I believe there's something that institutions should be engaging with.
And you had another acronym there for this closed off courses. Another one I heard was the massive online open degree, which I think Georgia Institute of Technology has introduced. Do you think there's any possibility that degrees will be offered online in the future in these massive courses?
I think when you start talking about MOOCs as a form of online education, speaking personally here, you run into significant issues, because MOOCs are very content driven with a limited amount of peer-to-peer interaction, but extremely limited tutor-to-student interaction. And as that lovely saying, you know, if content was king, then universities would shut down and libraries would be everywhere. So a university education is more than the focus on content. It's about interaction. It's about discourse. It's about dialogue. It's about talking with those that are a little bit more knowledgeable than you are, and in turn, passing your knowledge on to others. It's this very much multifaceted educational experience. I think a MOOC suffers significantly in terms of the interaction, dialogue, and discourse, and leadership from a course tutor, lecturer, professors. So I think there's fundamental issues with it there. So, for example, in Trinity, we also run online education. And our first postgraduate online course started last September, the Postgraduate Diploma in Applied Social Studies. We do not use a MOOC model for that course. We have a small class, limited to 20. We do have the online presentation of content, but then we have other activities. We have live video conference classes. We have lots of discussions, interactions, activities, all of which are assessed and marked. So it's a fundamentally different model to the MOOC model. So it'd be interesting to see the results of Georgia Tech and how they get on with it. But my gut feeling is MOOCs are very useful in the panoply of ways of modern education, but they're not going to replace the degree, either face-to-face or online.
I think that's interesting, the difference between a MOOC and an online degree program. So apart from the size, can you just say again how they're different?
I think MOOCs have a very straightforward, what we call an instructional design model, which is basically, here's a pre-recorded video of content, and then please read this article, and then please answer this question. And then possibly the fourth stage might be, now please have a look at others' answers. So three out of those four stages are individual, and the only interaction is between the content and the learner. Whereas if you think about what happens in a university setting, even in what we might consider a traditional lecture, which I don't think a traditional lecture even exists in the way that a lot of people perceive it, you'll get an introduction, you'll get group work, you'll get discussions, you'll get challenging questions, you'll get peer teaching, you'll get peer review, you get this sense of a cohort with a common purpose, where it's small enough to know a significant number of your peers intimately to know what they think and they believe. So it's a highly interactive, dialogue-based discussion organised by lecturers, whereby halfway through a lecture you'll realise that misconceptions are arising, so you completely change tack and you suddenly go, actually no, I need to go back and I need to correct something here. Or a student will say something that allows you to make a linkage to another element on another module of the same degree course. So you have that flexibility, and that to me is what the art of good teaching and learning is about. It's actually this collaborative journey. The M, the massive in MOOC, really diminishes that aspect and makes it a much more delivery of content-focused learning experience. So it's valuable, but it has its place. I just don't think its place is really as a replacement for higher education in a formal sense.
Whereas a lot of the other aspects of the traditional campus can be captured in online learning if you have smaller numbers, can be recreated in online learning.
If you have smaller numbers, so you have the sense of a class cohort and a class community, if you have a huge amount of interaction from the lecturers, I mean, there's a misconception out there that online lecturing means less work for the lecturers. I'd like to warn my faculty that are engaging with me in online learning, actually, get ready for this, it's the reverse, because you are constantly monitoring the discussion boards, the online chats, the Facebook and the Twitter feeds. You are engaging, you're reviewing the learning journals and the blogs and all these other kinds of interactions that the students are sharing with each other and with the staff members. And of course, you're running the live video conferences with the small group. You know, in effect, you're sort of seeing the whites of their eyes, but you're watching their learning journeys and you're monitoring and you're going along their learning journeys with them. On a MOOC, when you've got 20,000 people, you just lose all of that side of things. You lose the spontaneity. You lose the sense of, intellectual discourse and dialogue that I think is fundamental to what we do in institutions such as Trinity.
And who are those people who do MOOCs? Who are the 20,000 that you had in Trinity?
It was a very interesting when we got the data and saw who they were. Most of them were aged between about 30 and 50. Over 50% of them already had a primary degree. The motivations is something that we're looking at now. In terms of geographical spread, approximately half of them were from Ireland, and the next two significant student populations were in the United States and the UK. But we had students in over 100 countries doing our MOOC, which was, you know, some of them were really obscure countries going, how on earth did somebody in Papua New Guinea stumble across our MOOC on Irish Lives and Revolutions and want to do it? In terms of gender balance, it's about 50-50 from what we could discern. And I think what distinguished our MOOC was, as it went through, there was such a high level of interaction and engagement with the content and the comments and the online discussions. That really was some of the data. Our students were very engaged, and we found that very pleasing to us. It's something we hoped for, but obviously on that scale, you're never quite sure what's going to happen. But that was the kind of cohort. That said, we had people at 18 and retired people doing it for interest as well. So a very broad range, but that gives you some idea of the focus of the students.
And at 3,000 completions out of 20,000 students, that seems way higher than the norm, because I've heard it can be as low as 10% or even 3%.
It can be a lot lower. The exact breakdown was you had 20,000 people register, of which 12,000 started. So in effect, 8,000 people decided not to do it between start and finish. But that's understandable. It's the internet. So to register is just a click of a button and register email address. And then when it actually came to start, they were alerted but decided not to. So if we start with 12,000 learners that ended up as three, that's a 25% completion rate. And anything over 7 or 8% is considered a success. So we were really, really pleased. Now, it was a lot of work. We had weekly emails and people engaging with their online discussions as much as we could with that scale. But to us, that was a success. There is a very open question in MOOC research at the moment about why do you lose that 80, 90%? And the latest research that I've been engaged with and talking to people in the academic network around FutureLearn is it's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes people will start a MOOC purely because they're interested in the subject. Do I like history? And then they might do a week and go, well, I've now answered my question. I don't like history. So therefore they stop. So to them, it's actually been a successful MOOC experience. They've answered their need, which is the question of, do I like history? Others, for example, might be looking at this as in, well, I'm doing this to supplement, and we had evidence this, an existing course I'm doing. So their motivation was to absorb as much of the content as they could to assist a separate learning they're going on. So their commitment to finish was very high. Others, because obviously, in effect, this is part-time study, commitments, especially with this cohort of 30 to 55-year-olds, multiple commitments of work and family and social lives, might have just gone, well, actually, I don't have the time to invest in this, even though we pitched it at between 2 and 6 hours a week of engagement. Others might have just been interested in one aspect and just dropped in for that 1 week and gone again. So we've actually met their needs. So the high level of drop-off, I don't think you can compare it to, say, retention rates in third-level institutions, whereby if you lost 90% of your students, there'd be lots of questions from the vice-chancellors of the provost. But I think with the MOOC, we have to recognise what it is and the multiple motivations for people to engage with them in the first place.
To what extent do you think it is introducing new people, to third level education, or making third level education available to people who would traditionally not have gone to university?
That's a very good question, and it's one that we've been looking at within the Future Loan Consortium itself. What I think is important to note is that the actual content of a MOOC is really critical in understanding the motivation of the learners to register and engage with it. So if, for example, we're doing our MOOC, which is this period of Irish history, there's a great interest. A lot of people are doing it for informal learning needs. If, however, you're doing a MOOC on, say, you know, Chemistry 101, an introductory to chemistry, or an introduction to teacher practice, or I think then you would see a different set of demographics in the users that were engaging with it, because then you're much likely to get the people that are interested in, okay, let me see if I can engage with a chemistry degree or become a teacher, because it's giving you the basic grounding and getting you an understanding of the area itself. For example, there's a MOOC on the FutureLearn platform that had not many people sign up, but a great success rate, and that was dental photography. Because those that were doing it were really interested in the subject. So it didn't get a lot of people, but had the highest retention rates of any MOOC. So I think the actual content of the MOOC will dictate the kind of demographics.
You've mentioned a few areas of content there, from dental photography to chemistry and history. Do you think that there are some topics that are just not suited to MOOCs, or do you think there are some topics that MOOCs really suit?
That's actually a fundamental question in the whole area of education and technology. Initially, the sort of 20, 30 years ago, we were very much focused on the fact that online education, whether it's a MOOC or whether it's a BBC Two black and white television broadcast, it tends to be very good at procedural knowledge, at basic knowledge of a domain, factual knowledge. But as you move up and you start getting into, okay, now how do I apply this into a different area? Or what are the principles at work here about applying these knowledge sets into a totally different domain? Then people say, well, these kind of non-interactive, almost broadcast media aren't so effective. Over the last 20, 30 years, though, I think we've realised that there are very interesting techniques, educational ways of actually allowing people to engage with different types of content. So the classic thing would be, okay, teaching car maintenance, where there is a very procedural route to doing changing an oil filter, is very easy to do online, or YouTube, and there's lots of ways of doing it. But actually teaching the principles of jurisprudence or copyright law, which is very much a case of applying principles in new and innovative domains, well, that needs a different way that isn't so suited. There's an element of that. But to me, with the new technologies of discussions, and as we as a species are getting more used to discussing online, and blogs and resources, I think there's ways that we can get that more principle-based, I suppose we've got higher order kind of content, critical thinking content can be facilitated online, but it's a little bit harder.
So you would be happy taking your car to a mechanic who had learned their trade from a MOOC?
I would be happy taking it to somebody who had learned their trade but done MOOCs as well. So they might have learned their trade in traditional apprentice model, which is a fabulous way of learning, the traditional apprentice model. But then, as and well, say a new kind of servos came out, had done a MOOC that keeps them up to speed with that. So they've got their good grounding, but then they're very aware of all these other ways of expanding their knowledge, informal learning, all these other techniques and strategies that makes them much more rounded and current with the state of the art of the area that their skill lies in.
You've mentioned platforms a few times during our conversation. How important are platforms? Organisations like FutureLearn and Coursera, is that a platform as well?
Coursera and edX, and yes, the platform is really just, I suppose, it's a glorified website from the user's perspective, and that's the best way to think of it. I think it is important because theories of learning, as you know yourself, and how we think about learning can be almost hardwired into the way that you build the site that the learner engages with. So obviously all of these websites have the ability for you to log in. So you have your own personal login. So that's one element of the platform, we call it the website. And then they have to have the ability to display the audio and the video and the ability for you then to discuss and interact and for you to submit bits of content for others on the site to review and give you their feedback on. So that's the basic kind of functionality. Part of the reason that Trinity opted to join the FutureLearn Consortium was based on their platform. They've gone very, very much for a social learning approach. So unusually, each piece of content has its own set of comments. It's a bit like YouTube, whereby you put your comments under the content. So you don't have a discussion board for a week. You have discussion boards for each little item that's in there, whether it's an article or a slideshow or an audio. So you're directly discussing the content that's next to it. The lead on this is the Open University Professor of Educational Technology, Professor Mike Sharples, who I know very well. I'm a huge fan of his work. And from day one, he said, it's not about content, it's about interaction between the community. So FutureLearn has a built-in, hardwired, hard-coded social learning aspect in it that I really like. So there is an element on the platform. The other reason we went with FutureLearn is FutureLearn basically has a focus on quality institutions. So it's the 21-22 Russell Group universities in the UK. We were the first international partner. And we as a partnership basically assess institutions that wish to join. Not only that, but unlike other platforms, when we've created our course, we don't just put it up ourselves. We give it to FutureLearn and they spend a month checking that it meets their quality levels before it goes live. So we've got good quality assurance in the FutureLearn platform.
And finally, Tim, if somebody wants to sign up and complete the MOOC that's starting in March, how do they go about it?
It's very simple. Using any web browser, they go to futurelearn.com and then they search for Trinity College and they'll come to our page and see our offerings there. And then you just click the red button that says register. Very simple registration process. It's just your email address and a username. And then they will email you before the start of the course with all the instructions. And there's guides on how to complete MOOCs on the futurelearn.com website itself.
And hopefully anyone that does that will complete it.
Hopefully. We've got a very good rate so far. I'd like to... That's our benchmark now.
An optimistic Tim Savage there, looking forward to the second offering of the Trinity College Dublin MOOC about Irish lives in war and revolution, exploring Ireland's history 1912 to 1923, which will begin on the 16th of March 2015. For those of you who are interested in computers and education, you will most likely know that the annual conference of CESI, the Computer Education Society of Ireland, takes place on Friday and Saturday next, the 27th and 28th of February in Galway. The keynote speakers this year are Tim Rylands, Sarah Neild and John Davitt. You can find out more about the conference on the website CESI, that's www.cesi.ie, and I certainly look forward to being there and to recording some interviews for broadcast on future programmes. Well, that brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to Tim Savage for his time. If you'd like to leave feedback on the programme or make a suggestion for a future programme, please go to the website insideed.com, where you can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes. You can also keep in touch with the programme on Twitter at InsideEd. But for now, until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.